Welcome back, everybody. Moving right along, as they say. Get your seats, get your seats. This is going to be a killer panel. I'm so excited to listen to this. Coming up now, we got magicians versus psychics.
Is it just me, or does the whole skeptical thing just sound dated? Like this clip from James Randi's 2013 Amazing Meeting Conference.
Okay, here is the haiku for magicians versus psychics. Both groups flat out lie. You know, magicians, psychics. Only one's honest.
Dated in a Johnny Carson kind of way.
James Randi is here tonight. And he is the author.
It's still amazing to me that just a few short years ago, real scientists like Richard Dawkins and Neil deGrasse Tyson really embraced this skeptical nonsense that was stirred up by James Randi, especially since, as I tried to explain to today's guest, Brian Dunning, the creator and host of the Skeptoid podcast, James Randi has been outed as a liar over and over again. This guy was caught lying over and over. He lied about Uri Geller. He lied about Rupert Sheldrake. He lied to dozens of people about the $1 million challenge, and that was found out. You know, the whole thing, he lied about his background. He claimed he was like this genius IQ of 186, and he didn't have to go to school. He had this special. I mean, his whole story was just one lie after another. And this guy, you really consider him a mentor? In what way was he a mentor or someone who you would kind of look up to?
Well, first of all, I want to say I don't know anything about any of those charges you just threw at him. And I don't judge my friends based on what other people say about them.
Now, skeptics still can provide a backdrop, if you will, to the real frontier science that's going on. And I tried to explain that to Brian in this interview, but we didn't get very far, so I'll include some additional clips at the end of this show. But it sure seems to me like this whole skeptical thing is over. And like Brian's new film, Principles of Curiosity,
the result? Many of the new science discoveries you hear about on the TV news or read on a consumer-focused website really are, more than likely, wrong.
It all sounds a little dated. Stay with me. My interview with Brian Dunning of Skeptoid is next on Skeptico. Today we welcome Brian Dunning back to Skeptico. Brian is the creator and host of Skeptoid, a long-running and very popular podcast about skepticism, and he's just released a new documentary film titled Principles of Curiosity. Brian, welcome back to Skeptico. Thanks so much for joining me.
Hey, thanks. Been a long, long time. A lot of water under the bridge. It's good to be back.
It has. I looked it up. It was 2009.
Oh, my gosh.
We've both been doing this for too long.
Yes. We got into it knowing that it would lead to bigger and better things, right? Here we are.
Yeah, well, and then here we are. Well, it's funny because I did look up that last show, but and it's interesting. I don't know how much we've changed, which is kind of interesting in and of itself. But tell me, I think a lot has been going on. You've done a lot of episodes on Skeptoid, and you need to bring people up to date on that. And then on this new movie of yours, Principles of Curiosity. So give us a brief recap. And really, Brian, you know, start with kind of your background, who you are, and then a little bit maybe about the show.
All right. Well, so my background is in computer science, and my best academic credential is writing for film and television from UCLA. Now, it's hard to kind of combine those two things. And so for years and years and years, my career was basically just doing computer science stuff. And when podcasting came out in 2006, it's like, hey, here's a chance to finally combine my interests, the writing, the entertainment, and the science. And so I started doing Skeptoid. I found out what podcasts were, and I listened to a couple of them, and I remember back then, that was probably 2005, 2006 that I first learned about them. And I guess Steve Jobs had highlighted skepticality at one of his keynote speeches. And so I checked that one out and I'm like, I've heard this. Yeah, I remember. I've heard that guy, James Randi. I've heard of that before. And I kind of discovered that there was the whole skeptical community kind of centered around Randi and his amazing meeting and all of that stuff. So when I started doing my podcast, which was October 2006, it was kind of, you know, my take on the usual skeptical issues. Whether they were personal interests of mine or not, I just kind of started doing shows about what I thought I was supposed to be doing shows about. And, you know, I was fortunate in that people really responded to my show and they liked it and they began supporting it. And it eventually was able to become my full-time job. Then it became a nonprofit and now it's a decent little running concern. But over all of those years, the show evolved, not a whole lot, because consistency is super important in having a successful podcast. But the show evolved, I'd say, mainly in terms of the type of content, as it shifted more toward my personal interests. And my personal interests also probably evolved just over the course of this deep, deep exposure to all of these topics. And I'd say that the kinds of subjects that I like the best have to do with the science behind urban legends, events in history that are either misunderstood or misrepresented. And that's really, I think, what I would say my true love is. Like, if I cast my eye over recent episodes, I did one about relic Japanese soldiers. There's always these urban legends about a Japanese soldier who comes out of the jungle and he doesn't know that the war has ended and he still tries to take people prisoner with his rifle. Was there ever any truth to that? So I did a show about that. Then there was a really famous UFO incident, Lonnie Zamora and the Socorro UFO. And if anyone knows ufology at all, you've at least heard those names. So I got to dig in and find out what that was all about and find out how that was eventually solved. You know, I try to be much more of a science writer and a science journalist rather than making my own conclusions. I report the conclusions that the real experts have made in whatever the subject matter is.
And how did that lead to this movie, Principles of Curiosity?
Yeah, so over the years, you know, it's interesting because you find out what your listeners respond to by them writing in and telling you. And what I got a lot of positive response was from teachers. Teachers were using my podcasts in their classrooms. They were writing up their own courseware. They would send me the courseware they've created. They'd create a whole series of lessons based on groups of podcasts that were all on the same subject. So I began, that was when we kind of changed the company, made it into a nonprofit. So, you know, it's no longer not something that I own anymore. I now work for the nonprofit as an employee. I'm not on the board of directors. There's real people who do all of that stuff. So it's much more legitimate and it's much more independent. And the purpose of the nonprofit is to provide free educational resources for teachers. So we still do the podcast and I make sure that the podcast is scholarly, meets certain standards in terms of having the references and everything provided. It's free to educators. You can get the whole show is of course free to everyone, like every podcast is, but educators get a version of it that doesn't include ads and they get everything on a USB drive and things like that. And so this movie, Principles of Curiosity, was really the biggest and best project that the nonprofit has done as, you know, its own separately financed project to address the need that these teachers have expressed. So it's something I'm super proud of. It's free to the world. It's on YouTube. You can see it at principlesofcuriosity.com. And there's also a fantastic courseware package that's on the website that's free to download. And I've got people right now who are promoting it to teachers worldwide. We're trying to get it in with the National Science Teachers Association and all this stuff. So it's really fun. It's really exciting times, and it's just super rewarding work. And I couldn't be happier with what I do for a living.
Well, that's awesome. The film is certainly extremely well done. It looks fantastic. So you guys obviously have some skill in production. So that's...
Well, yeah, a professional film crew actually made the movie. I was just there. I wrote it and showed up and did my presentation on camera and everything. But that was one thing I wanted to make sure we covered very well from the beginning. So it was done with a professional production company, New Rule Productions, and on all the latest, greatest camera equipment and everything. And all that was fun to be a part of.
Because the reason I'm kind of so curious, I've been interested in the skeptical community kind of from the beginning of this show. And there's been this kind of headbutting between frontier science and the skeptical community. And you've broadened it. I understand, the interest you have in the Japanese soldiers from World War II and all that stuff. I've always stayed interested in kind of consciousness science and frontier science. And in that realm, I've always been interested in who your audience is, like you just described. And I guess I kind of get the science teacher thing at like a really low level. But, on a more personal level, I have a good friend, really good friend. I mean, this guy, I've been to his wedding. I know his kids. He's been to my wedding 30 years. We used to work together for a long time. Big fan of your show. He listens to your show because he likes it. He listens to my show because I'm his friend, but he really listens to your show. And I'm always curious, who is the kind of person that goes in for this kind of thing? Last time you were on the show, that long, long time ago, I tried to kind of bridge that gap by saying, hey, here's a topic that we both kind of know a little bit about. And I do the same thing here to try and dig a little bit deeper into what's kind of really going on, because so I'm looking for shows that you've done, a topic that we've covered, and I didn't have to go very far. Just a couple of months ago, Skeptoid Podcast 577, you did on precognition and psychic abilities. Do you remember that one? It's just a couple of months ago.
Sure.
So you want to run down the basics of what you were trying to kind of cover there?
So what I did was I went out to – I've got a big Gmail list of listeners who have volunteered to help with research sometimes. And so sometimes I'll throw some questions out to them. And I asked them, hey, have you had any kind of a strange experience that you can't explain? Record it on your little voice memo feature on your phone and email it to me. And I don't know. We probably got 40 or 50. And interestingly, the by far the largest group of them was people who saw a single point of light UFO. And I did an episode where I played all of those together. And the second largest group was people who had explained or expressed some story about a precognition type of event that happened to them. Either they were thinking about something and then it happened, or... that kind of thing. They wake up in the middle of the night and they find their aunt died or something after dreaming about the aunt, that kind of thing. And so I did an episode where I compiled, I don't know, four or five of those that were all similar enough that we could talk about them as a group, and talked about one potential explanation for all of them.
So great. And the reason it caught my eye is we've done a bunch of shows on that as well. But there's a lot of research that's been done on precognition. And in particular, it's been kind of a hot research topic because the parapsychologists, the professional scientists who studied this, kind of made a lot of noise. I mean, Daryl Bem from Cornell University published his study a few years ago, and he actually made the circuit of the TV shows. He did the Corbett Report, which is unheard of for these parapsychologists. And then there was this controversy where Richard Wiseman, the famous skeptical scientist, came and said, no, it's all bull. I mean, were you aware of all the research that's been done on precognition?
It's not an episode that I had researched for some time. This particular episode that I did was just talking about these particular stories that were sent in, so I didn't include other stuff. But to give a more general answer to your question, is that something I'm generally aware of or keep up with? Not as much as I'd like, because I'm just so overcommitted with my time on working on whatever episode I'm working on. I don't really get as much time to keep up with fun topics as I wish I did.
But you did a show on the science of precognition.
This 577 episode you're talking about?
Yeah.
Well, it wasn't the science of precognition in general. It was about these particular stories that were sent in by listeners and what might have been the case for these.
Well, kind of. But, I mean, let me drill into this a little bit more. You start out that episode by saying this. First, it's important to lay the groundwork for the conventional science-based explanation for apparent episodes of precognition. It comes from the law of large numbers. I mean, Brian, no, it doesn't. I mean, people have studied precognition for the longest time because it's something that has been widely reported across cultures throughout time. These people have these experiences of feeling like they know the future, or like you said, dreams. So they've studied this, and they've actually studied in the lab. It's not that hard to study. You know, most of the research that's done on precognition is based on an old freshman psychology experiment that's been going on for the longest time, where you sit a student down and you say, okay, an image is going to pop up on your computer, and it's going to either be bunnies and kittens, or it's going to be something really horrific or something really sexy, and let's see how you respond. And so that work they did without even being interested in precognition, but being interested in the physiological responses we have towards images. And then a guy named Dr. Dean Radin said, hey, I wonder if I could use that same experiment, because we have such good data on it, and turn it into a precognition experiment and see if people react before the images are actually shown. And technically, that isn't even precognition. That's presentiment work. But that experiment's been replicated, 20, 30 times by labs all over the world. And then this latest round, the last couple of years, where Wiseman really just totally flubbed that one with Daryl Bem from Cornell and then Julia Mossbridge from Northwestern, is they kind of did a twist on it where it isn't really presentiment in terms of measuring biological things, but precognition, seeing if people really did know what was going to happen next. So the reason I go into all this depth is this is the complaint that so many of us have with the skeptical community. It's just incredibly science light, ultra light, to the point where it isn't even science. I mean, this is the research on precognition. This is the only thing to talk about, not some hokey thing of the law of large numbers or something.
Well, obviously, you're not telling me anything I don't know, but you can look at any out there field, Bigfoot, alien visitation, flat Earth, and you can say exactly the same thing that you just said about precognition. There are lots of people studying it. It's being replicated in labs all around the world. Where it becomes something that I would report on my show is when it passes scrutiny and gets into the major scientific journals and is accepted by the community at large. At that point, it becomes an accepted science that I would report on my show.
But Brian, this did. I mean, that was why it made such news, is Dr. Daryl Bem, highly, highly regarded in the social sciences, did get this published in a major journal in his field, and that's why he made the rounds on the Corbett Report and the New York Times and all the rest of it. And that's why your buddy, your skeptical buddy, Richard Wiseman, went to such great lengths to try and debunk that experiment. And, you know, I mean, we can get into all that detail, but that detail is what's really, really important. That's where science happens.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I hear this all the time from people who email me about whatever their pet special thing is. And, you know, why don't I report it because of all of this and all of this? And it's so legitimate. And so many people have replicated it. You know, I've got to draw the line somewhere. And where I draw the line is when something becomes broadly accepted by the science community.
But you did
report
it. When
that happens, I will take pleasure in reporting this guy's work. I'm not familiar with him. I don't know what the paper was, but that's basically where I draw the line.
I get that in one sense, and I won't persist too much further. But, I mean, the point is, you did report on it. You did a show on precognition. You just got it wrong.
What I reported on was, what is the currently scientific accepted explanation for precognition reports? What you're describing is that there's actually some extrasensory perception ability is not yet the science, the mainstream consensus on how that works.
But you understand what I'm saying?
When it becomes so, I will take pleasure in doing an updated episode.
Right. But you reported on the conventional science-based explanation. These are your words.
Yes.
For precognition is the law of large numbers. There is no...
Yes, that is what my show was about, was the accepted science explanation for phenomena.
That would have nothing to do with the precognition experiment that I just talked about. That cannot be... The law of large numbers cannot in any way explain that experiment, right? Because there aren't any large numbers in that case. It's, if it's presentiment, it's the physiological response. If it's the precognition, it's the guessing before the answer is known kind of thing. There's no law of large numbers there.
Yeah, well, like I say, I have not read that report, and nor would I if it's something from a fringe journal, or if it's something that wasn't replicated or that received criticism in the next issue of the journal, you know, whatever it is. I try to set a pretty high bar for what I report.
Okay. Let's move on. I tell you what, the other thing I want to talk about is the skeptical community thing that you mentioned earlier, because it seems to me and a lot of other people I talk to that, you know, the skeptical thing is kind of over. I mean, the JREF, James Randi Foundation thing is over. The Amazing Meeting thing is over, and over in kind of a pretty dramatic way. At least that's what I thought. And then I read, you know, again, I was researching for this show, so I referenced your thing. A year ago, you wrote, the demise of TAM, that is the Amazing Meeting, this annual conference that James Randi had where all skeptics were invited to kind of get together. And the JREF, James Randi Educational Foundation, which never really did much education, as we've now come to find out as the financial reports have been issued. But you're saying that the demise of that, I'll quote you, happened for exactly the right reason and no other. Our friend James Randi, considered a mentor by many of us, has simply retired. I mean,
yes.
Brian, that's just not accurate. There's no mention that their revenues were declining, that they had to fire all the staff. There's no mention of the sexual harassment scandal that just tore the whole community apart. There's no mention of Randy's other legal problems. I mean, is that really accurate to say, hey, he just retired?
In my opinion, yes. The guy's, I don't know how old he is, you know, 80, 90 something.
Yeah,
88. He's quite old. He's quite feeble. He's a good friend of mine. I keep in touch with him. There's no way he is up to attending a conference right now. You know, he'll do limited appearances and things like that, but, he's quite old and quite feeble. He requires care. Running the JREF was simply out of his hands. And I think it was the right time to step back. Everyone's sad. I mean, everyone really enjoyed TAM. It was a great place where I enjoyed going every year to see many friends that I'd see once a year. I know a lot of people who felt the same way. It was a lot of fun. I'm definitely sad that it's over with. I mean, maybe you want to consider me a hostile witness or a biased in that case, but I certainly am biased because I really enjoyed the conference. I really enjoy him as a friend and as a mentor.
As a mentor, I understand the friend part, and I understand that you enjoyed the conference. My point was just that the skeptical thing is just kind of over. I mean, skeptics, you know, for whatever reason, don't have quite the same status. There isn't quite the same oomph to the whole thing that there used to be. And part of that is surely, you know, that JREF isn't around and TAM isn't around. But I want to go back because I'm still stuck on this idea that you consider him a mentor. I mean, this guy was caught lying over and over. He lied about Uri Geller. He lied about Rupert Sheldrick. He lied to dozens of people about the $1 million challenge, and that was found out. He even, you know, the whole thing, he lied about his background. He claimed he was like this genius IQ of 186, and he didn't have to go to school. He had this special. I mean, his whole story was just one lie after another. And this guy, you really consider him a mentor? In what way was he a mentor or someone who you would kind of look up to?
Well, first of all, I want to say I don't know anything about any of those charges you just threw at him. And I don't judge my friends based on what other people say about them. So,
I mean, you can Google it. I mean, I'll pause right now. You can Google all that stuff. He claimed that, not me. I mean, any one of those, but that's fine. If you don't want to get into it, that's okay too.
But how do I consider him a mentor? I really didn't. I remember being my first exposure to him, like most people, was seeing him on The Tonight Show when Carson would have. And Carson, of course, was a major donor to the JREF. But when he would have people come on, and, you know, as a boy, I always heard about, you know, paranormal things and these ESP and telekinesis and all these great abilities and thought, wow, that's the coolest thing ever. You know, can that actually be real? And then when I saw it actually being tested in, you know, I don't want to say controlled conditions because you're very limited in what you can do on The Tonight Show. But when I saw it being tested and failed and hearing it explain why, that, like, that was so eye-opening for me. It's like, whoa, so there's, you know, it's not necessarily a fact that this guy is able to move things with his mind, that there's other explanations for it. For me, that was a wonderful learning experience, and it really opened up new horizons for me. And I became fascinated with the idea of digging past the popular portrayal of strange phenomena, digging into them and finding out what's really going on. That fascinated me. He introduced me to the concept that that was even a thing you could do. And I would say that's the reason I consider him a mentor.
I get part of that. You know, I can't get past the kind of honest liar ethos that he was all about. I mean, they even did a movie documentary about James Randi, The Honest Liar. And that seems to be a pretty good catchphrase for where he was always at. I mean, he was always an end justifies the means. If I have to trick or fool you, I mean, it's really the antithesis of science. It's the exact opposite of what science aspires to do. So when he's caught, you know, lying about Uri Geller or lying about Rupert Sheldrick, if he was truly in the science realm, it would be game over. You can't lie like that and still have a following and still have a reputation. I never understood why the skeptical community continued to embrace this guy when all these things were kind of revealed.
I'm not familiar with anything like that having been revealed, so I really can't answer your question.
It's so easy. I mean, if you just Google, the whole thing with Rupert Sheldrick was way out in the open.
I'm not familiar with it. I'm happy to try and talk about it if you want to, but I mean, tell me what it is that happened with Rupert Sheldrake. And you know, I've never met Rupert Sheldrake. I know vaguely something about him, but I'm happy to give my opinion if you want.
Well, one, the fact that you don't know is, I think, telling. But Rupert Sheldrake did this experiment with dogs that appear to have some kind of psychic connection with their owners, that they know when their owners are coming home.
So that's all I know about him.
Right. So Randi claims, hey, we tested all this. We tested all this and we have all the data, and the data shows that it isn't true. So Sheldrick, and if you know Sheldrick, and I've interviewed him several times in this show, many times, and talked to him, I mean, he's a Cambridge biologist and he's soft-spoken kind of British guy, but he doesn't tolerate this kind of bullshit very easily. So he just persisted and he just stayed on Randi, and Randi had to eventually admit that no, he hadn't really done the tests, and he created all these lies in the interim. He actually said that the data was lost in a hurricane and that there was a flood, all these just outrageous lies until he eventually admitted, okay, I don't have any data on it, and I'm sorry, Sheldrick, I have to retract. He said that privately, and publicly he kind of took this middle position. But the same thing happened with Uri Geller, where he said that Uri Geller was tested extensively at Stanford Research Institute by some very, very competent researchers, Hal Puthoff and Russell Targ. You can still watch the video out on YouTube of what they did. I mean, these guys know what they're doing. And they were able to validate that Uri Geller was able to perform these things in a lab. And then Randy just lied. He just lied. He said that the guy who videotaped those experiments was faking them. And the guy came out and said, that's completely ridiculous. I'll go to court. I'll sign an affidavit. I'll do anything you want. It's completely made up. And again, you know, Randy had to back off of that one. Again, these are kind of things that would completely, if the guy was a real scientist, anything approaching a scientist, he would be completely ostracized from the scientific community. And yet he's still kind of held in high regard by a bunch of skeptics.
Well, he doesn't claim to be a scientist. As far as I know, he's a magician.
But you're a science writer and you say he's a mentor of yours.
I mean, so is Benjamin Franklin, but I've never flown a kite in a lightning storm either. I mean, there's a lot of people I respect and that I've learned from. I don't have to be claimed to be in their same professional field. I've never heard anything about Randy issuing big retractions and apologizing for having lied about people. I've never heard that. Also, I'm hearing it now from someone who obviously doesn't like him or respect him very much. So, I mean, if you'll forgive me, I'll take it with a grain of salt that what you're reporting is a literal true account of what he actually said. And, maybe we should move on because, like I said, I'm not familiar with these situations. I'm not the guy to talk about them with.
It takes about 5 minutes to Google that. Anyone can find it. So, yeah, I'm not making this stuff up.
I do all of my research based on substantially more than 5 minutes of Googling. That's not enough to persuade me of just about anything.
Well, take as much time as you want. The fact that you don't know it is surprising to me, but that's okay.
I mean, obviously we've all heard the Uri Geller stories though. I mean, he no longer even claims that what he did was real. He now describes himself as a mystifier. And I think the criticism against him for, you know, not returning all the research money that was spent on him is well justified. I mean, you can't argue that he was not a professional con man for his whole career, because he said that the four basic tricks that he does that anyone can replicate, he always claimed that those were actual magical abilities. And I don't think that ever fooled any professional magician. And I know a lot of people were kind of miffed that he did go out into the world and tell people that it was real abilities. And he took research money from people who were easily fooled.
Who are you referring to that he took research money from?
Well, the Stanford incident that you were talking about.
But no, he wasn't. That wasn't a matter of easily fooled, and he didn't easily fool them. And their experiments still stand up. And you've misread that situation. Like I'm telling you, that's one that the way it eventually plays out is Randy is found to be the liar, not Targ and Puthoff, who have a stellar academic career in these experiments they set up, which, again, anyone can watch. The videos are still up there from Stanford Research Institute, are rather easy to kind of see and to replicate. You know, I just did an interview with Dr. Jacques Vallée, the famous UFO researcher, known for that, although he's a solid scientist and computer scientist of quite amazing stature in himself. But, he tells the story in the interview about sitting down at the table with Uri Geller at lunch when he was doing the experiments at Stanford Research. And just impromptu, Geller said, okay, let's do this experiment. And, I mean, anyone can go listen to it. And, again, Jacques Vallée, if anyone's read his work, he's not a rube. He's not someone who's going to be easily fooled. And, he along with many, many other credentialed scientists have validated that Uri Geller was able to do these things.
What is his What is his profession, if you don't mind my asking?
Jacques Vallée?
Yeah.
Well, Jacques Vallée is a scientist.
In what field?
Well, I mean, you can go look at, I mean, he has an extensive history, but I mean, he was a world-class computer scientist. He was a venture capitalist in Silicon Valley for the longest time, also an entrepreneur for the longest time. He's best known as...
Could I tell a quick story about an email exchange I had this morning?
Of course.
That I think is relevant to this, because he's a computer scientist, he's a venture capitalist. None of those suggest that he's an expert in stage magic. I got an email this morning from a guy about an old episode I did on the Skoll experiment way back long ago in the UK, where the Society for Psychical Research hired some seance performers to do a seance for them. And they wrote it. And this happened over many times over a period of, I think, over even a year. It's been a while, but it was a fairly substantial series of
more than a year
seances. Yeah, it was a big project. And they even invited people with expertise in magic, and stage magicians like Richard Wiseman came in and observed some of these. And this guy was the guy who emailed me this morning said, you know, hey, you know, your conclusion didn't really represent the conclusion of the experts who were there. And I said, well, who were the experts who were there? And he listed, you know, a handful of people who were expert. One was an electrical engineer. One was a physicist.
Rupert Sheldrake was there too.
Pardon me?
Rupert Sheldrake was there too.
Okay. He's a biologist, you said?
Right. Cambridge biologist. Right.
Okay. So biology, physicists, electrical engineering. None of these people you would have any reason to suspect they're experienced in stage seance performances. Those are completely irrelevant fields of expertise. The few people who were there who were familiar with seance performances basically came out laughing and saying these are silly tricks that have been familiar to seance performers for 100 years. So I had this email back and forth with this guy. He was saying, but this guy's a physicist. He's going to know all about how magicians get out of illuminated handcuffs. Why would he know that? Experience matters. You can complete an academic program in biology. That doesn't mean you have years of experience with magical tricks. Those are totally, totally different fields. And one thing that we hear all the time is that scientists, people with experience in some particular physical science, some hard science, are easily fooled by magicians. Now, when you go to a magic show,
we hear it. It's just not true. I mean, we hear it repeated by the skeptical community. It's just never something that's been shown to be true in any kind of scientific way, where someone's done an experiment and tested a bunch of scientists or applied any kind of scientific reason to that. So it's just one of those urban legends that you like to report on that is actually not true. Parapsychology is the most rigorous field of science. That's not my opinion. That's the conclusion that people have done that have studied it, because there's been so much debunking and so much skepticism applied to it that they've had to adhere to the highest level of double-blind studies, carefully controlled, all that stuff.
May I ask you, how many working scientists do you feel would agree with the statement that parapsychology is the most rigorous science?
I'm telling you what the research, I mean, first of all, that's,
I mean, do you think that's really that's really what most scientists would agree with?
Brian, you obviously aren't familiar with that research, but I can send you the research and see. This is where I think you have a fundamental, in a lot of ways, misunderstanding of science. The whole purpose of science is to remove us from the kind of biases that are loaded into that question. Good science takes a question and tries to solve it the best way they can and then presents the data. So someone did that in this case. They said, is parapsychology scientifically rigorous? Well, they said, okay, how would we measure that? Well, double control, double blind studies are of the utmost importance in terms of measuring that. They'd say replication is. They'd say a bunch of different factors, and then they'd go out and look at it, which is their methodology, what they did. So you can argue with the study they produced, but you can't just switch over to this mode of just saying, well, what do you think, Joe? Does that jive with your belief of how things work? I mean, it's not science.
You know, I've got some friends who are biologists down at the Scripps Institute, basically working on cancer cures. They're going to spend their entire careers with one little aquarium that's got basically pond scum floating in it. They're going to spend their entire careers, maybe 40 years, going in there, taking out one little sample, putting it on petri dishes, incubating it, testing its effect on various pathogens, looking for something that can be developed into a drug. And they'll probably both finish their careers without ever making a significant discovery. And this is the reality of how science careers go. It's a lot of ridiculously hard work, very little expectation of payoff. And the reason we have to go through that is because once in a blue moon, we do get that payoff, and it is worth it. Every single working scientist I know would love nothing better than to make an earth-shaking discovery. And what you're telling me is that earth-shaking discoveries are out there. They're made all the time. They're just not published or known for some reason.
When did I say that?
I can't imagine a single working scientist I know who wouldn't change careers to jump all over that and get it replicated and get it published. When that happens,
what are you referring to that I said?
Pardon?
What are you referring to when you said that's what I said? When did I say that?
Well, the whole time we've had this conversation, you've been telling me, oh, things like precognition have been proven and published and are well accepted by science. That's just not the case, because if it was, it would make it into the journals. And people would be changing careers to work on it. I mean, obviously, you don't like Richard Wiseman very much, but I know him pretty well, and I know he would change everything. He would drop everything to research full time once it was proven that there was some sort of paranormal ability.
I won't bore you with the Richard Wiseman story on the precognition, but it's the clearest example of the honest liar ethos that you could kind of ever do. Maybe I'll include it in the show for the benefit of listeners, but.
Well, what do these people get out of lying? Why wouldn't they change careers and work on this? Why would they simply lie about it? How does that benefit them?
I don't know. I mean, that gets into...
Well, then maybe you should question whether that's actually what's happening.
Well,
if it doesn't make sense for someone to do it, then maybe they're not doing it.
Well, when I said I don't know, it was really kind of a rhetorical answer because, you know, it gets into the whole question of people's motivations and trying to understand that relative to controversy and as well as conspiracy, which is, you know, we probably won't have time to get into talking about today, but it's another topic you talk a lot about that I think is kind of central to kind of trying to wrap our arms around this. But you know what, maybe what we ought to do in the time that we have is return to this movie, because I really do think people should check this out, because unless you want to persist on that, but go ahead. Should we talk more about the movie, or do you want to talk more about conspiracy, or do you want to talk about Richard Wiseman? What would you like to talk about?
There's actually a good segue from what we're talking about now into the movie, and that's one of the points that I make in one of the scenes of the movie is about how science reporting to the general public is usually quite poor. And the reason for that has to do, in many cases, it has to do with the PR departments at research institutions, because their whole job is to attract attention and funding to their institution. And you do that by making it appear that you've made huge science discoveries. And so PR departments at universities will often exaggerate or put these wild and crazy headlines on research that comes out of their institute. And I use two examples of actual headlines: one pill cures all disease and invisibility cloaks are real. Those are actual headlines that came out of university PR departments over the last, I don't know, 5 or 8 years. And the headlines grossly misrepresented what the actual research had been. And The whole reason that this happens is because the institutions desperately need to attract attention and funding. And so if there is anything outrageous or unusual or surprising that comes out of it, you'll not only hear about it, you'll hear about it in letters that are 25 feet tall and blinking and flashing. So until I hear these kind of headlines coming out of major research institutions, and then everyone in the world would be jumping on it to replicate it the same way they do with the fusion discoveries and the discoveries they make at the major particle colliders. Everyone has to jump on the bandwagon to replicate it. They've replicated the gravitational wave detection. You don't have the hardware to do that everywhere, but wherever they did, they have. And if something of this magnitude happened in psychology, I'm pretty sure the same thing would come out in the news. Maybe you're right and I'm wrong and it hasn't, I've missed it. I will absolutely take pleasure in correcting my show and reporting on this new generally accepted fact if it does in fact exist.
So you kind of touched on this before, but tell us more about Skeptoid, where that show is heading, and, you know, does it come out every week? And you said you mentioned sometimes, you know, users or listeners write in. Do you have interviews? Is that part of it? Or do you plan on changing the format at all? Tell us more about the show.
No. So it comes out every 7 o'clock, every Tuesday morning, has for almost 11 years now. I only missed one week, and that was the week that, unfortunately, my sister passed away back in 2007. But other than that, it's never missed an episode. It's short. Each episode is between 12 and 14 minutes. They're single subject. So if you want to, pick your topic, there is a show that's specifically about that and about nothing else. There's no chit chat. There's no me telling what's going on, et cetera, et cetera. It's just pure content, single subject, short format. And it's basically just me talking. So it's a spoken word show. It's not an interview show. And that's, you know, almost all podcasts are interview podcasts. I don't have the data, but I bet if we sat down and did an analysis, we'd find that over 90% of them are interview shows. And I always wanted to avoid that since that's what everyone else is doing. So.
We got to talk. It's fun to talk. Like we said, even at the beginning, we have very different points of view. And one of the things that's been a long time frustration for me is, and I give you a ton of credit for coming on the show and facing, you know, tough questions and that kind of thing. But this kind of dialogue, I think, is not just interesting to people, but I think it's important, you know, I mean, especially in the climate we're on now, where groups just seem to choose not to talk and to just completely polarize themselves. You know, I think the discussion, the dialogue is important.
Sure. I enjoy it thoroughly. It's just, that's not just what my show is not about, just because, you know, that's a separate thing. But,
sure.
I very much appreciate what you're saying. I enjoy the engagement very much. And I think if I were to do interviews, it would exclusively be with people that, that I disagree with. Either that or I would do the opposite kind of show where it would just be more straight science reporting and I would just bring on scientists and have them discuss their work and, you know, I'd ask them questions in a way to frame it that the general public can understand and appreciate because, you know, I think science literacy is one of our nation's weak points and I think it's a place where we can do the most good by helping people to become more scientifically literate, giving people the tools to understand what's real and what's not. Helping people to recognize science from pseudoscience. I mean, I go out with friends for dinner and almost everyone will be talking about the latest juice cleanse that they're doing or the latest superfood that they're eating. That this misunderstanding of basic science is just absolutely rampant in our culture. And I think there's a lot of room to improve the world by improving general science literacy. So that's kind of the whole purpose behind Skeptoid, the podcast, and in a larger sense, Skeptoid Media, the nonprofit.
Great. So our guest again has been Brian Dunning. Skeptoid, you just heard of the podcast, and you're also going to check out his new movie that you can watch completely for free on YouTube, Principles of Curiosity. Brian, thanks again so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me on. It's always good.
Thanks again to Brian Dunning for joining me today on Skeptico. I could go on and on about how surprised I am that Brian didn't know the extensive work in precognition research that parapsychologists have done over the years. But I'm not surprised at all. But for the benefit of you listening, because we really didn't get into that very much, and it really is an amazingly interesting bit of science and an interesting chapter in science history, particularly because of Wiseman's deception and then Daryl Bem's follow-through, and that, you know, so Daryl Bem publishes the study. It gets this considerable amount of attention. Richard Wiseman comes on the scene and just debunks it and does this whole dramatic debunking exercise that for anyone who's serious about it is completely unfair and unconvincing, but it fulfills the desired goal in terms of clouding Daryl Bem's work. And then it further obscures what he does later, which is he does a proper replication that is actually replicates the experiment 90 times and then publishes that. So anyways, I discussed a lot of this in episode 328 when I had a chance to talk to Dr. Michael Britt, who's a bit of a skeptic and had done a show on the Daryl Bem thing. And of course, he got it totally wrong, but then, hey, what are you going to do? Here's that clip. And I'll show you what a complete charade and just hijacking of science this whole thing is. But to get there, maybe we should jump to the end story, which is here's what was published in 2015, a study by Daryl Bem and others titled Feeling the Future, a meta-analysis of 90 experiments on the anomalous anticipation of random future events. And I'll read from you from the abstract. In 2011, Dr. Daryl Bem published 9 experiments in the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology demonstrating precognition. To encourage replications, all materials needed to conduct them were made available upon request. It's important to note that here is a guy who was very much into open science and was encouraging replication from the beginning. Continuing with the abstract, we here report a meta-analysis of 90 experiments done by different experimenters, different labs, exactly the kind of best science that we would expect. 33 laboratories to be exact in 14 countries that yielded an overall effect greater than 6 sigma. So P1.2 to the 10 to the minus 10th. That is a gaudy, gaudy statistic. And he says this greatly exceeds the criterion for decisive evidence in support of the experimental hypothesis. I've listened to your shows. I don't think you are a fire-breathing skeptic or a disinformation agent or someone who's intentionally going out to try and mislead people. But I'll tell you what happened here. If you look at the timeline, Daryl Bem publishes this study that we're talking about in January of 2011. Then Richard Wiseman, who is been accused and has an unbelievable amount of evidence against him being deceptive in these ways. And I'll play you a clip from Daryl Bem in a minute where he calls him out on being deceptive. I've also interviewed Dr. Rupert Sheldrick, Cambridge biologist, who did a one-on-one debate with Wiseman on this show and called him deceptive. But here is how the deception was played out in this case. Imagine this. Bem publishes in January of 2011. The paper actually didn't even come out until March, but it was available to people in January. Wiseman comes out and says, okay, we're doing a replication of this. Anyone who wants to do a replication, you have to have it in by June. Okay, first of all, that is unprecedented, unheard of, unreasonable, and doesn't make any sense. Why would there be a time limit of 6 months? Are psychologists, social psychologists, supposed to drop everything that they're doing and try and replicate this experiment? Are they supposed to get the funding for it? Bem himself.
Did you ask him that? Did you ask Wiseman that?
not on this case, but just watch the way it plays out, right? I mean, this guy, Bem, was open to replication. And he did it
he compiled here, as you can see, 90 replications over the last 5 years. It's unreasonable for anyone. We don't even have to ask. It's transparently unreasonable to say that this is going to be the final finish line 6 months from now for all replications, and then to hurry and publish your results. But he does something much worse. Let me then play for you the second clip, and that's from Daryl Bem when he appeared on my show, and he talked about this very situation. Here you go. Hope you can hear it.
When you publish an article, even if it's of your own three experiments, you always have a literature review section where you talk about all the previous research and known research on the topic before you present your own data. And what Weissman never tells people is that they knew that there were three other studies that had been submitted and completed, and two of the three showed statistically significant results replicating my results. But you don't know that from reading his article, and that borders on dishonesty.
So I know that's kind of long, but you know, there's a lot of detail to get in there, and actually there's a lot of detail that I left out regarding effect size and statistical significance, all the stuff that's really interesting, at least to me, or to anyone who's really interested in answering this question scientifically. There's really a lot to dig into, and it's really not that hard. You just have to have the desire to look it up. So that's going to do it for this episode of Skeptico. I will tee up one question. Is the skeptical thing over now? Is it over? Or is it not over? I'll tell you what, Brian Dunning still gets 150,000 people downloading his podcast every week. Now, I don't know who those 150,000 people are, and I don't know that I'd have a lot in common with them, but they're out there. But for the rest of us, and for the overall zeitgeist that we're in, is the skeptical thing over? That's the question. Love to hear from you, either from the Skeptico website, the Skeptico forum, Facebook, however you find me, however you get to me, let me know what you think. I have a number of really good shows coming up. I'm really excited to bring them to you. As always, I appreciate you listening, appreciate you sharing and telling people about the show, and I, of course, love hearing from people who have gotten value out of the show. So if you're out there and you like the show, tell me. I love to hear from you. Well, that's going to do it for this episode of Skeptico. Do stay with me. Until next time, bye for now.